This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we learn what vision problems can accompany headaches and be a sign of something more serious. Plus, we'll explore all you need to know about heart failure. But first, we discover what constitutes good perinatal care and why it's so important. Well, having a healthy pregnancy is one of the best ways to promote a healthy birth and a healthy baby. And getting early and regular prenatal care improves the chances of a healthy pregnancy. Here with more on this is Dr. Alexandra Spadola. She's Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University and the Obstetrical Director of the Central New York Regional Perinatal Program. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Help us understand what we mean by perinatal care.
Perinatal is a term that refers, as you said, not just to the birth event itself or to the pregnancy, but really linking it to a woman's life in the sense of the preconception period, which really is anyone who's of reproductive age and healthy and not actively preventing conception, as well as to the postpartum period.
So basically you're talking about things that health concerns or health consciousness, care around your health, if you could be of the age to conceive and therefore become pregnant.
We try to promote the idea of thinking about preparing for pregnancy, even if you're not actively trying to have a baby.
So give me a sense of when we say, what are the kinds of things that comprise this kind of care? Let's start with preconception.
Sure. Preconceptually, we work a lot with women who have medical conditions in which thinking about a pregnancy may involve looking at lists of medications and thinking about medication changes or discontinuing medications even prior to conception that may be dangerous in pregnancy. It's thinking about optimizing your health, whether that's improving control of diabetes or hypertension. It's about making sure that folic acid is part of your daily health routine. And of course, the lifestyle issues that we, you know, highly promote for everyone, which are being of a healthy weight and healthy nutrition.
How about things like, your family history and to just kind of go back over your family history and make sure there aren't things that are lurking that you might need to be tested for? Things like, for example, something that comes up in my mind, like Tay-Sachs disease or some kinds of issues like that.
Sure. I think, this is where primary health care providers can, when they're taking those family histories, identify the things that younger women and men may not be thinking of that might affect them in terms of the, you know, less common kinds of genetic conditions that may run in family. So certainly we always promote the idea of talking with your parents about health conditions.
But how about things also that are always, to me, in my mind, important around a pregnancy or the health of a pregnancy, like avoiding smoking or smoking cessation or, you know, minimizing the amount of alcohol intake or any kind of drug abuse, frankly. I mean,
absolutely,
those kinds of things.
The incidence of opioids and opiate use, unfortunately, in this country has increased about 300% over the last decade.
Wow.
So this is a huge piece that we're really dealing with in perinatal care. But certainly smoking cessation, that's one of the biggest lifestyle changes that a woman can make that will improve the health of her baby, again, not just in the womb, but postnatally as an infant. And we really, again, say that secondhand smoke is just as bad. Maybe even this idea of third-hand smoke, where smoke is in the clothing or in the carpets, and babies who are, you know, certainly close to floors and their environment, may be affected by those factors.
And people don't really understand that or are sensitive to those, especially this third-hand smoke idea.
Yeah.
Once you're pregnant, what are the kinds of things you recommend? I mean, how frequently should you be checked? What are the kinds of things that should be taking place?
Well, researchers have shown that women who enter into care in the first trimester are going to have healthier outcomes. It provides us that first opportunity after a woman finds out that she's pregnant to, again, address some of those lifestyle issues, some of the environmental factors, such as nutrition. Interesting data on things like the pesticides that we use in our home, making sure people are aware of their environment, not just the prescriptions that their doctors have given them, but what's around them and how that can affect their developing baby.
And the doctor will be doing kind of blood tests and all kinds of ultrasound.
We do a lot of screening on that first visit, again, looking for some of the family risks and just general health factors. Are you up to date on your immunizations? Are you vulnerable to certain infections? How's your blood counts? Are you anemic? Things that may, again, change some of the recommendations as pregnancy continues.
How important is folic acid? You alluded to it earlier. Tell us about it. What does it do?
Most people, we hope, understand that folic acid is one of the few micronutrients that really has an impact on the developing fetus in terms of a woman not being deficient. This is primarily been promoted as a way to decrease the incidence of birth defects, specifically a group of conditions called neural tube defects. This includes spina bifida and a very severe condition in which the cranium doesn't develop, something called anencephaly.
Does folic acid occur in our daily diet generally, and how often? I mean, is it, you mentioned that especially perinatally or prenatally, you might actually want to make sure that somebody starts taking that as a vitamin supplement. So why is it necessary to supplement it, or is it necessary to supplement it?
So one of the big public health changes that happened when we recognized the link between certain birth defects and folic acid was that it is in a variety of foods, grains, cereals. So oftentimes women are getting some in their daily diets, but we do feel that an extra amount is important, especially for younger women or women with health conditions such as diabetes, where an extra, making sure they're really fully supplemented with folic acid may lower their risks.
So therefore, it's really included in all of these pregnancy vitamins.
Exactly. It's part of the perinatal multivitamin.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Alexandra Spadola, and we're talking about the importance of perinatal care, both to protecting the health of the mother and obviously that of the baby. So you are involved. Central New York has a regional perinatal program. Tell us about that. What is it?
Sure. Well, my predecessor, Dr. Richard Aubrey, in the 1970s, recognized that in areas like Central New York, where there's large distances between hospitals and varying levels of care for mothers and babies at different hospitals, that creating a network in which women could be triaged and transported to higher levels of care would improve infant outcomes. And so that program, which was one of the first in the country, started in 1976, and it's been a really remarkable success story in terms of lowering the infant mortality in Central New York to this day. What we're emphasizing as time continues is that while we've improved infant mortality, nationally maternal mortality has slowly increased over the last several decades. And this is a multifactorial problem.
Yeah, name some of the things that are contributing to that.
Yeah, so more women have medical conditions that increase their risks in pregnancy. These include diabetes, hypertension, obesity. We know that on average, more women are delaying childbearing after the age of 35. That may increase some of the health risks of pregnancy. And historically in this country, especially women who live in poverty, have not had as good access to preconception care and early prenatal care. And we're hopeful that some of the changes nationally with the Affordable Care Act will help women really be in better health and have better access to care prior to pregnancy.
So the idea here is to create an outreach, kind of a network, much like you did before, or much like this program did before for the health of the babies, now that the focus is somewhat more on the health of the moms. How do you outreach with the different hospitals regionally? Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, here in Syracuse, we receive anywhere from 1 to 4 transports a day of women coming from our outlying 18 hospitals that refer into the perinatal program, which is a joint effort between SUNY Upstate Medical Center and Krause Hospital. So it's a wonderful way in which hospitals around the region, from Messina to Binghamton, can send oftentimes their pregnant patients who are hospitalized to see us and hopefully deliver if they need to here at Krause with the care of the excellent NICU, neonatology service.
So if they were to give birth here because they were developing some kind of problems, I don't know, give us an example, preeclampsia,
sure.
Some kind of...
Sure, so some of the most common are severe early preeclampsia.
Help us understand what that is.
Yeah, preeclampsia is unfortunately one of the biggest contributors to mortality and a lot of health complications around the time of delivery.
For both mother and baby?
For both mother and baby. For babies, it's a big contributor to prematurity. It's a condition of hypertension in pregnancy.
So they develop in pregnancy a high blood pressure,
right.
Abnormally high.
Abnormally high, and most often in the third trimester, rarely even in the second trimester. And it's cured essentially by delivering the baby. We think of it as a somewhat abnormal conversation between the placenta sending messages to the woman's body. And so delivery seems to cure the woman. Although we can still see complications in the postpartum period. And unfortunately, severe hypertension and stroke can be some of the preventable complications that happen after a woman has left the hospital after her delivery.
So if a woman shows those kinds of high-risk issues, symptoms, how does your regional center deal with it? Just take us through that. What happens?
Sure. So oftentimes, a woman is transported for intensified surveillance in a hospital setting. Especially when a woman is not yet term in the pregnancy, there may be a role for watching and waiting for the baby to avoid some of the severe effects of being born premature. So we do that with daily monitoring of the baby and daily monitoring of the mother so that we can really optimize the health outcomes for both parties.
So basically, they'll be delivered here, and then, as you said, you have a neonatal... I mean, they'll be watched, and then if necessary, the baby will be delivered early, and then the baby will be in a safe harbor, so to speak, with a very highly developed neonatal unit.
Right. So we have a level 4 unit. We have the largest neonatology unit in the region, and a lot of experience of improving outcomes for the smallest and earliest babies.
You also mentioned that there's been a focus more, even within the state, on the health of women, of the mother, so to speak. Tell us more about that initiative and what it's about.
Right. So this year, 2 initiatives are starting. One is through the Department of Health, and one is through our professional organization, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. And these initiatives are surrounding preeclampsia, again, this disease of hypertension that can really place the mother and baby at risk, as well as obstetrical hemorrhage. So unfortunately, both of these conditions can happen to women who are otherwise healthy and have no predisposing risk factors for either of these events.
I don't want to run out of time. What is the state doing, just very quickly?
So what we're doing is collecting data and having some interventions that will be performed at all hospitals to ensure that some of the evidence-based practices that have been shown to reduce some of these maternal severest of consequences are placed in every hospital in the state, again, trying to optimize and prevent some of what we think is very preventable poor health outcomes.
Wonderful. Well, it sounds like you're really on a roll here with all of this, and it sounds like you're taking this whole idea to the next level, especially focusing now on the moms as well. I want to thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Alexandra Spadola. She's Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University and the Obstetric Director of the Central New York Perinatal Regional Program. Once again, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Next up, what visual problems during a headache can signal something more? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Well, for some of us, it can only be an occasional annoyance, but for others, a chronically painful and debilitating problem. But in any case, headaches can interfere with your daily functioning and could be a sign of something far more serious. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Melissa Coe. She's a neuro-ophthalmologist, an associate professor of neurology and of ophthalmology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Coe. Thanks
Good
for
morning.
Coming in.
Good My morning. Pleasure.
Well, let's begin by reviewing some of the main types of headaches that people suffer from. I understand there's headaches that are called primary headaches. Can you tell us about that? What are those?
When you see the term primary headache, it means that it's not due to another cause. It's not due to a tumor in your head or due to any other process. It's just that you happen to have them, maybe hereditary, your family has them, and you have now developed them yourself.
So what are the kinds of headaches that fall into those categories?
Sure. So our garden variety migraine that a lot of people suffer from is one type. A lot of people suffer from tension-based type headaches. And then there are some headaches that are far more rare, but are called cluster headaches.
You know what I'd love to do? I'd love to go through some of these with you and understand, first of all, what causes them and, what they exactly are. So a tension headache, let's start with that, because I think that's probably the most common headache that most people are familiar with. They occur, I guess, throughout the population very frequently. I actually saw something that one statistic, according to the World Health Organization, 1 in 20 people in the developed world suffer from a daily tension headache. Now, that's kind of astounding. What is a tension headache and what causes it?
So a tension headache is not unlike the moniker that it's been given. It's due to stress of those muscles that are right around your head area, your scalp area. Usually, you don't start with them during the day. They kind of come on as the day progresses, as perhaps more tension and stress seems to carry through as you go through your work day.
So we look at it as really stress-induced.
There is a huge component to stress and how you're holding that muscle tension.
How about migraines? You alluded to that right off the bat. I mean, that seems to be something I read somewhere where it was the second most common kind of headache. You tell us about migraines. What causes them and who gets them?
That would be the holy grail answer if we knew exactly why. There have been a couple streams of thought over the decades of the cause of migraines. It's been thought at times that maybe it's due to something vascular, meaning affecting the vessels and how they constrict and how they dilate, that could be affected. But medications that solely target that don't completely resolve the problem. It's thought that it might be an inflammatory cause. And so we know that some of those over-the-counter anti-inflammatories can help to resolve or abate those symptoms, but that alone didn't explain it. And so I think that it's going to be far more complex than just one specific answer.
Who seems to get them? I mean, I'm a sufferer of migraines, and I notice a lot of women get them, but I understand that even children do get them and boys
Absolutely.
Get them as well.
Absolutely. And in fact, in childhood, it could present differently. It's not uncommon. I've seen where children can present with just the visual symptoms, not the actual headache component. They can present with cyclic vomiting over and over again. Or maybe some people, once you've talked to them as an adult where they have the full-blown headache of migraine, and you ask them back in their childhood, they would become easily motion sick, easily car sick, constant vomiting, sick days from school as a result of it. So I think those are other manifestations in childhood besides just the typical, I need to have the lights turned off and the room quiet type of migraines.
I'm going to get to kind of treatment options
Sure.
going forward, but I want to know a little bit. I know this is less common, much less common. It's a rare type of this primary headache called cluster headaches. What does that mean?
Right. So it comes under a rubric of headaches called trigeminal autonomic cephalgias. That's a fancy term. But what it means is that there can be these bursts and like the term almost suggests, clustering of headache pain.
Does that mean you get them successively in a given week? Let's say you might get a headache every day.
Or actually, in the setting of cluster, it could patients, what they've described to me is that they literally feel like an ice pick is at their head repeatedly over and over again within a short period or bursts of time. say, within a couple hours, just repeated attacks.
And do those kind of run in families as well? I mean, what do they know about those?
Right. Cluster typically, although it can happen in both men and women, is more commonly seen in men. There are other features that go along with it. We know that sometimes they can have eye findings. They can have excessive tearing of the eyes. They can have excessive nasal drainage at that moment, and also redness around the eyes and pain.
But they don't really understand what causes it?
There isn't a complete understanding about the cause of those.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with neuro-ophthalmologist Dr. Melissa Koh, and we're talking about headaches, something we all can relate to. So we all know that headaches can really affect the quality of our life, but some of them resolve quickly, and other people, I'll be honest, myself, when I have a migraine, is really a debilitating experience. But I also know that some can actually mimic strokes.
Yes.
So how does one know when this is something more serious?
Right.
I mean, which of these headaches are something to really pay attention to and not just try to take your over-the-counter medications?
Exactly. Headaches that can cause you to lose a function. So if you are actually, you know, you're not just your typical, I've got a headache pain, but my vision's become blurry, it's persistently blurry, I'm losing speech or the ability to speak clearly. I think we all saw an example of that with a journalist. Within the last few years, she was on the air, developed a complicated migraine, not your typical one, and started to speak nonsense, and they were worried about a stroke in her. I've seen patients where it mimics a stroke, where they are losing strength on the, you know, one half of their body. So anything like that where there's a clear neurologic deficit, like speech, like strength, like vision, that should be looked at.
Let's get to the visual, because I know you are a specialist in that as well. Visual symptoms that can accompany a headache. Tell us what they are. I know from my own experience, visual auras come with migraine. I myself don't always get a headache with the aura. Sometimes they occur separately. Tell us about that. And again, when do we know that can be really something more serious?
Right. And sometimes that can be hard to sort out. But I think things that reverse within a period of time, oftentimes migraineurs who also suffer with a visual aura will say, you know, I get the aura, and then about 15 to 20 minutes later, boom, the headache comes on. So, you know, that fits a very clear sort of textbook description. I think that the symptoms that continue to persist, you know, meaning that it doesn't just resolve, it is there all the time. Headaches where you wake up first thing in the morning, you know, that's a clue that you want to make sure there isn't something more nefarious that's going on in the brain.
Give me some examples of things, for example, that could be going on when you have a visual symptom.
Right. So the things that typically go with aura type would be, you know, people can describe glittering dots, jagged lines, a kaleidoscope of colors. And sometimes children don't even want to say this, and adults don't want to say it because they think, you know, are you hallucinating? But no, these are descriptions. People sometimes describe halos around objects. So aura can really be widespread. I think the visual symptoms that are more concerning would be, I'm missing vision. You know,
in other words, part of your field of vision is gone.
Part of your field of vision is gone, or maybe that just an entire section of your vision is gone out of one eye. If you start to notice double vision, that's also something that should be looked at.
What are some of the things, though, the actual problems like pseudotumor, for example, things like that? Tell us what some of the medical,
sure,
neurologic conditions that could be underlying a symptom that accompanies a headache.
Absolutely. So pseudotumor cerebri syndrome is a condition that is of my own research interest and expertise. It's a condition, can be seen in both men and women, but predominantly women, and predominantly women of reproductive age. We know that we see it mainly in settings where people are overweight or above ideal body weight. We don't fully understand the mechanism, but my research is centered on that with weight loss, interestingly, the entire condition disappears.
So is this something that's life-threatening, the pseudotumor, or is it, I mean, how is it treated? What do we do about
exactly
it?
Exactly. It's not life-threatening so much as it is sight-threatening, in that if left untreated and ignored, and unfortunately I've seen cases like this, one can completely lose their sight or any of their working vision.
So if you do have some of these symptoms, that's a definite clue or a warning to get help.
Well, let me outline some of what those symptoms might be with pseudotumor. People might not be aware. Double vision is one. Very blurred vision that persists along with headaches and maybe nausea and vomiting that don't just continue through the headache, but just continue to be intractable. The other feature is that some people don't realize, with change in position, sudden, brief blackouts of vision, lasting seconds. I've had patients who thought, doesn't everybody have those? No. That kind of blink in, blink out type of vision. And also the sound of almost your heartbeat inside your ear, a whooshing sound that actually pulses directly with your heartbeat.
Wow.
That's also a feature that can go with it.
But this can be treated.
Yes.
As can these other things we'll talk about. They all have treatment options.
Absolutely.
How about temporal arteritis? I saw that as another, that has visual symptoms with headache as well?
Exactly.
We typically
see temporal arteritis in an older population, 6th, 7th decade of life. This is a condition that would be extremely unheard of in younger people. It is due to inflammation of the large vessels, outside of the internal vessels of the head. So they're the vessels on the outside of the head, and can actually directly affect some of the vessels that feed into the ones that supply the vision.
And that causes what kind of visual disturbance? How would you know you had temporal arteritis, for example?
Really bad headaches. Difficulty with chewing food, severe pain with chewing food on that same side, sudden loss of vision in the same side as where you've had that scalp tenderness and pain. You can have new arthritis with that. In addition, symptoms of loss of weight, loss of appetite, fevers, chills.
So, and even strokes can come to the eye as well. You can lose vision from having a small stroke in the eye.
Absolutely.
So I guess what I want to summarize here, first let me ask you this, and then I want to get to the summary of when to pay attention and when to get help. Does the severity of the pain always indicate the seriousness of the condition?
It doesn't always perfectly correlate, because you can ask many migraineurs and they'll tell you this is the worst pain ever. I think some of these other headaches might be more subtle. And so if they go along with any of the neurologic symptoms we've talked about today, that would be a clear indication.
So
I need to see a specialist for this.
And then clearly you first do what? You first, if you're having those kinds of symptoms, any kind of loss of speech, loss of vision,
something that abrupt,
pain.
That is a trip to the emergency room.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And if something is maybe ongoing for a few days, you should be calling your primary
care physician. Absolutely.
And then possibly seeing a specialist, because there can be very serious things underlying these visual disturbances and the severity of pain that you're
absolutely
feeling. Dr. Koh, thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Melissa Koh, Associate Professor of Neurology and Ophthalmology. She's a neuro-ophthalmologist at Upstate Medical University. Thanks again so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Meditations on Meditation, or Dr. Strangelove, How to Stop Worrying and Love the Om. Well, folks, I started an experiment a few months ago. I'd read a book called Positivity by a psychologist and researcher, Dr. Barbara Fredrickson. She wrote about all the research showing the positive effects of meditating on how we feel and think, on our physical health, on how satisfied we are with our lives. So, always on the lookout for things that do those very things, I decided to try meditating. Nothing fancy, just the basics. 15 minutes a day paying attention to my breath, my in-breath and my out-breath. And when thoughts came up that diverted my attention, gently bringing my attention back to my breath. My discovery so far, first off, this meditating stuff is hard. Second off, actually, It's only hard if I have some high standard for how I should be doing it. And guess what? That should is just one of those thoughts that, you got it, take my attention away from my breathing. And I thought, I can adjust that standard because it's just one of my own thoughts. And I don't have to compare myself to one of those all day, every day, for their whole lives meditating guys who can stop their hearts from beating or whatever. Third off, Shakespeare or whoever was right. Oh, what a tangled web we weave. My mind is often like one busy little spider who's had too much coffee and can't stay focused. Fourth off, a lot of what my worried, jumpy spider does is not very pleasant. Fifth off, I don't have to put my time and attention on that and that and that and that unpleasantness if I don't want to. I can choose what I think about. And then I discovered that I can breathe in a sense of all the people who love me and breathe out my love to them. As the Buddhists say, loving kindness to me and loving kindness to you. I'm Dr. Rich. O is for Omeal O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Coming up next, what you need to know about heart failure. Listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. Here's our Healthy Monday Minute for this week. Losing weight while eating this summer. Well, you don't need to starve yourself on a wacky fad diet if you want to look better in your shorts or swimsuit this summer. The best foods for losing weight are light, refreshing, and natural. These foods are common in the summertime, and it's easiest to avoid those heavy meals in the heat. Dietitians recommend these six foods to help lose weight during the summer months: chilled soups, watermelon, grilled vegetables, salads, no-calorie beverages, and fruit-based desserts. How about a cup of gazpacho, a grilled veggie pita, and a slice of watermelon? Enjoy the summer while eating healthy. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. According to the American Heart Association, about 5 million people suffer from heart failure. Each year, about 670,000 new cases are diagnosed, and more than 275,000 people will die of it. Many heart failure patients can lead a full life, though, when their condition is managed with either proper medications or a healthy lifestyle. But here with more on this is Lori Langdon. She's a registered nurse and the coordinator of the heart failure program for Upstate's University Hospital. Welcome, Lori. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So heart failure, it's a really serious and sometimes fatal diagnosis. Tell us why that is. What exactly is heart failure?
Okay, heart failure is actually it's a clinical syndrome. And what happens with this is the heart is just unable to pump strong enough to meet the demands of the body. So basically, it's just the heart can't pump strong enough.
So is it something that comes on suddenly, or is it something that's a slowly progressive problem over time? How does it come on?
It can come on more than one way, actually. Sometimes it is a chronic condition, typically. And so a lot of times people will have the symptoms and they don't even know it. But the other scenario would be after a heart attack. If someone's had a heart attack and they've had a lot of damage to their heart, then you can develop heart failure from that. And that is more the situation where it would happen more suddenly. But for a lot of people, it happens over a period of time.
So it's slow, it can be slow and progressive if it's not from some trauma like a heart attack.
Yes.
So what does the heart do? I read somewhere that it does things like begin to become larger, the muscle increases. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the most common reasons that people get heart failure is high blood pressure that is untreated. And what happens is the heart is pumping so hard against your blood vessels because when you have high blood pressure, the arteries are very narrow. And so the heart has to work very hard to continue to pump that blood through those arteries. So over the time, the heart does become enlarged.
It pump faster? Or?
Well, it will try to compensate. Our bodies do a wonderful job trying to compensate for our health conditions. But like anything, sometimes too much of a good thing is too much. And there's a whole series of hormonal events that happen within the body to try to compensate for when the heart is getting enlarged and is weaker. But those things only help to a certain point, and then they actually start to hurt the heart.
So when we say failure, I mean, it's called heart failure. What do we really mean? Is the heart failing? What does it mean?
No, it's not failing. And that's what we always explain this to the patients because we're always afraid that they think that their heart has failed. And it hasn't actually failed. It's just that it can't pump as well as it used to. So another name for heart failure, too, is congestive heart failure or CHF. So people may have heard those terms as well. But the bottom line is it just means that the heart's not the pump of the heart. The heart is a pump, and it's just not pumping.
So it's not about to stop.
Exactly.
It's just that it's having trouble doing its job.
Right.
So who's most at risk for this kind of problem?
Well, anyone who has hypertension that is untreated is at risk. But the elderly are definitely, the older that we get, and especially people over the age of 65, are more prone to getting heart failure. And as a lot of people know, our population is just getting older and older, which is why the projection for people with heart failure just like doubles or triples in the next couple of decades because our population is aging. But also young people can still get it too. Children can even get it due to congenital conditions.
People who have had a heart attack, as you mentioned.
Yeah, anyone with a heart attack, people who are obese, diabetics are especially at risk as well. And there's different kinds of heart failure. So even people who have lung conditions like COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, they are also at risk for heart failure.
So how do you know you have heart failure? You said earlier in the conversation that you might not know you have the symptoms. Mm-hmm. So what should you be looking for? What are the symptoms?
Right, one of the most common symptoms that people get is shortness of breath. And we all get short of breath not maybe all of us, but for a lot of people, if you walk up a couple of flights of stairs, you get a little short of breath. But this is different. So I always tell people, know what is normal for you. And if an activity that you used to be able to do without any difficulty all of a sudden becomes more difficult or you become very short of breath, like walking up a flight of stairs makes you literally stop and you just are so short of breath that it's something different. You should not ignore those symptoms because there can be a lot of reasons for it. So that's why it warrants a visit to your doctor to have that explored. Another very common one is people get swelling of their feet or their ankles. And once again, you can get that for a lot of reasons, but people who have more right-sided heart failure, because your heart has a right and a left side to the heart, if you have right-sided heart failure, those people tend to get more fluid that backs up into their legs, into their feet. And what a lot of people don't know, and even patients who have heart failure, until we discuss this, you also can get fluid accumulating in your abdomen, in your belly. And so sometimes if pants that you normally wear fit you fine, and a week later they're just too tight or your belt's really tight.
Right, you wouldn't have gained that much weight in a week.
Exactly, yeah. So that can also be a sign. A lot of times heart failure patients will say, gee, I was like that, but I never knew that I could gain that weight in my belly. So,
how about things like fatigue?
Yes, and fatigue too. And once again, these are kind of, symptoms that we can all come up with reasons for why we feel this way. But if it's a fatigue like you have not had before, they're subtle symptoms, but you should really get them checked out by your doctor. Because often people, especially diabetics, do not get the typical symptoms for a heart attack or heart failure. So if you're more fatigued or things that don't normally make you short of breath do, it definitely helps to go to the doctor.
So tell us again, we kind of skirted over this a little bit. What are the causes that really contribute to this, the development of CHF or heart failure?
Okay. Like I said, high blood pressure is like one of the number one things. Heart attack, and even if you have coronary artery disease, and what that means is that you have blockages in your arteries. Typically, our arteries do not block overnight. It happens, it's a process that can start in your 20s, as early as your 20s. And over time, those arteries start to clog. So it just means that your heart's not getting as much of the blood supply that it should. So it just makes your heart have to work harder. So anytime your heart has to work harder, then it's putting you at risk for heart failure.
How about things like atrial fibrillation, where the heart goes into irregular beats? Does that also contribute or potentially make you more prone to developing congestive heart failure?
A lot of times people who have heart failure develop atrial fib.
So it's the other way around.
Yeah. It certainly doesn't help it any if you already have some underlying heart disease and then you have atrial fib on top of it, because atrial fibrillation puts your heart rhythm. Our hearts have a muscle component to it and an electrical component. And when that electrical part is out of sync, which is what atrial fib is, then it causes the heart to, it's just another thing that makes the heart a little out of whack and not pump as efficiently.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Lori Langdon. She's a registered nurse and the coordinator of Upstate's Heart Failure Program, and we're talking about heart failure and what can be done about it. Very briefly, how is it diagnosed? How do you actually determine that this is congestive heart failure or heart failure?
Well, typically, if people start to get those symptoms of shortness of breath, that the things that we talked about, sometimes one of the first things that your healthcare provider will do is a chest X-ray. And if you have heart failure, it will show that your heart is enlarged. And if you are in heart failure, and by that I mean you can have your heart can be weakened and not pumping as well, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you are actively in heart failure. So, but if you are, you're going to have fluid in your lungs. So there's a lot of people who have heart failure, but they're what we call compensated, which means they're doing okay. They're not in heart failure at that moment, and they're not going to have fluid in their lungs. But if you're someone who's short of breath, you're fatigued, you all of a sudden have this cough that won't go away, especially a cough that comes on, wakes you up suddenly out of sleep at night. Those are symptoms of heart failure and that you have fluid in your lungs. So a chest X-ray may be the first thing that will pick up a sign that you need to have things checked out further. An electrocardiogram will show that electrical activity of the heart, and that will just give some signs that possibly one of the chambers of your heart is thickened or that your heart rhythm is abnormal. So those are two very basic tests that would lead your healthcare provider to think, I should probably get this checked out further. That and by listening to your lungs and assessing you.
And then you might even go for a cardiac catheterization or things like that if those things are pointing in that direction.
Yeah, even before that, the test that really helps diagnose heart failure is an echocardiogram.
Okay.
Typically, that may not get jumped to right away because you may do the X-ray and the EKG first, but the echocardiogram is a non-invasive test. It's easy. It's does not cause any pain or discomfort, but it works by sound waves. So just like women who are pregnant who have an ultrasound, it's like that, but of the heart. And that tells allows us to look at the structure of the heart and how well the walls of the heart are moving.
So those are really the elements that would make for a definitive diagnosis.
Yes.
But I guess I don't want to run out of time. How is it treated? What is the most important things for people to know should they be diagnosed with congestive heart failure?
Okay. So the biggest things would be if you're overweight, lose weight. Things like alcohol and drugs, especially things like cocaine, really do a lot of damage to the heart. So avoiding those things, eating a heart-healthy diet, and limiting salt, because salt holds on to water, and water just makes more work for the heart to pump the blood around. Quitting smoking, like all those things that we all know that we're supposed to do. But once you get diagnosed, there are certain medications that are a standard of care for heart failure. And one of the classes is an ACE inhibitor, and another class is called a beta blocker. And those drugs, the biggest thing that I could say to people who have heart disease or heart failure is you have to take your drugs every day. And that, because those medications help your heart so that it doesn't have to work so hard. And I always tell people that if you can't afford them, this is a problem we see in the hospital all the time, is people who cannot afford their medications. Always tell your doctor or pharmacist. There are, most pharmacies have lists of drugs that are only $4. So
there are ways around it.
There's help out there, yes.
What, just very briefly, because as I said, I don't want to run out of time, are there other things that you find that need to be done? For example, implantable devices or pacemakers or surgeries, stuff of that nature.
Okay, depends upon what caused your heart failure. So if you have blockages in your heart, then you would you may possibly have a heart cath to see if you have blockages. And if you do have those, possibly getting a stent or open heart surgery. So that's one side of it. But the other thing is, heart failure is a chronic disease. It's not going to go away, but as you mentioned earlier, it is a manageable disease. So there are things like implantable defibrillators, certain kinds of pacemakers that all help to make the heart just work a little bit better.
And in your program at Upstate, you have the opportunity to help people find all of these different avenues.
Yes, we have cardiologists that specialize in all of these things, and all of these things that I mentioned are available at Upstate.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in. It's obviously a problem that, if it hasn't affected most of us as the population ages, it'll be something we'll all be looking at down the road if we're lucky enough to live long enough. My guest has been Lori Langdon. She's a registered nurse and coordinator of the Heart Failure Program for Upstate University Hospital. Once again, thanks a lot, Lori.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Pain is something that can perplex our physicians and nurses who want to help us manage it. Sometimes they give us a number scale and ask us to pick one. Or they might show us pictures of moon faces that are crying, grimacing, smiling, and they'd ask us to pick one of those. Or they might suggest we use a word to capture how the pain feels. Is it stabbing us? Is it throbbing? Does it ache? Well, poet Beverly Boyd from California tries her best to answer that question in her poem called Salt. A wave leaves you gasping, paralyzed till breath returns. Pinpricks radiate from elbow to wrist to thumb. Fire flashes through inner regions as currents flow. A nurse inquires, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is it? Your doctor applies labels, chronic or acute. All distress noted, rated, described. But how to reckon pain? As a steady companion? Cranky child? Unrelenting foe? Insatiable lover? Exacting rival? One who reminds you you're alive? Elicits gratitude for peace and ease? Strengthens the spine, yet augurs more torment if omen, infused always with that briny taste of fear.
you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn what's in place for emergency preparedness at University Hospital, plus how pets are being used to provide unique therapy for patients, and what does it mean to be a medical home? If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.